I struck out for the far side of the mango-infested swamp.
Grab my hand. I'll pull you out.
Eccles, how did you get across the swamp without getting wet?
I jumped on that log.
That log? That's an alligator.
Oh. I wonder why my legs kept getting shorter.
To Goonpod, vying with Oppenheimer and the Barbie film for pop cultural dominance this week. Before I introduce this week's guest, I just want a quick word about last week's show, The Treasure in the Tower. There was a line in that delivered by Bluebottle, "I'll be the man who sees nobody touches him for you." And I was speculating that that was perhaps the payoff or the punchline to a mucky joke or something like that. But it was pointed out to me by no less than three listeners, John Dredge, Phil Cannon, and Duncan Gray, that actually the line was inspired by a childhood friend of Sellers.
Bluebottle was a reflection of a boy I knew once when I was at kindergarten, going back a long time now, and I was 7 years old, and I bought a model in lead of Malcolm Campbell's record-breaking car, the Bluebird, and it was the first of the models, even in those days, and it was expensive, where you could lift the body off and you could see all the engine in lead. Everything was in lead, of course. And the wheels, of course, weren't properly shaped. They were sort of pressed over at the end, you know, so they wouldn't come off. But nevertheless, it was a blue. And I, you know, this was my pride and joy. And I took it to school, and all the kids were around there, all looking at it, you know, and running it on desks and things. And a little spotty Herbert came up to me, and I never forgot it. And he came out of the crowd, you see, jockeying for power. This is what it was, you see. And he said to me, "Can I be the man that sees no one touches it for you?" No, I never forgot that, because he wanted to give himself, he'd go up, you see, he'd be a manager then. Now, stand back, because I will tell you if you're allowed to touch that. Is he? Yes, you can do that. You see, he's then one up, now, and got nearer to it himself, so he could touch it whenever he wanted. Mm-hmm. But the others, and that was the basic philosophy behind Bluebottle. Mm-hmm. See, he was a very simple young lad, you see.
I did know that. I kind of, as with so much, it kind of just gets pushed into an inaccessible section of my memory, you know, and it's very difficult for me to access it. So thank you to those chaps who pointed that out and set the record straight. So on to this week. It's not often that I get people below the age of 30 on this podcast. It has happened. Even less likely that that person is from North America. And this week, I am joined by the writer, comedian, Zach Mitchell. Now, Zach is 28 years old and lives in Nova Scotia. And Zach contacted me several months ago and expressed a great love for the Goons and for the podcast. Thank you very much, Zach. And he and I started a sort of a Facebook conversation, if you like, and I suggested that he might want to come onto the show and talk about his love for the Goons and for comedy in general, pretty much. And he agreed, and what follows is our conversation. And Zach's a fascinating guy and has a lot to say, and very thoughtful character as well. And a lot of what he said sort of made me scratch my head and say, yeah, actually, never thought of it like that. So, anyway, onto the conversation, and obviously I began by asking Zach how he came to discover the Goons.
I discovered the Goon show because my dad told me about Python, and I looked them up on YouTube, and then bought the 16-ton set, and I remember reading their Wikipedia article and seeing them mention the Goon show, and I thought this sounds fascinating, so I just looked them up, and all of the episodes were on the Internet Archive, so I downloaded them all at once, and then I went on a vacation, and basically that entire vacation was spent listening to every Goon show from series 5 onwards. I listened to them all basically in one go in like a week. So,
wow. Okay. So was that in chronological order from like Whistling Spy Enigma onwards, or was it just
yeah? Random? Well, the first one I remember hearing was The Secret Escritoire with that amazing alligator joke. That was the joke that hooked me.
Okay. So that was the first Goon Show you heard, and that's quite a strong. That's quite a strong first episode. So, maybe if it had been a weaker episode, really one of the later. Although I know that you want to defend series 8, don't you?
I do.
But if it had been one, because there's a few duds in the Goon Show catalog, shall we say? If it had been one of the weaker ones, but maybe you might not have been so hooked so quickly.
I know, I would have. Like even. The Junk Affair, which to me is the weakest of series 8, it's got some good bits in it. It's got My Client Has Been Taken Ill with Head and all that. Yeah. So in even the weaker episodes, there's like 4 or 5 just brilliant jokes. So yeah, I'm pretty sure if I started off even with some of the low points of season 8 or even series 8 or series 10, I still would have been hooked.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, as you may have heard, because I bang on about it often, the first Goon Show I ever heard was the last episode from series 10, The Last Smoking Sea Goon.
Oh, that's a great one.
Yeah. Well, people are tend to be a bit down on it, but you know, I was just totally enchanted when I first heard that, because I didn't know what was going on. I had, and I'm going to ask you about this in a minute, but yeah. I'd never heard the Goon Show before, obviously. I was 13 or 14, yeah. But I had heard the audio recording of Bad Jelly the Witch that Spike put out in the 70s, and I'd heard that on a regular basis, so I was kind of like, what would you call it, a primer in getting into the Goons. So when I heard The Last Smoking Sea Goon, I didn't know what was going on. I thought that Peter Sellers was doing all the voices mostly. I thought he was doing Wallace Greenslade's voice even. but it took me a few, you know, I had to listen to a few episodes. I think I listened to The Lost Emperor and The White Box of Great Bardfield after that, and gradually started to sort of piece things together and started recognizing the different voices and being able to ascribe them to the different. Obviously, you could tell which voices Seacombe did, but the other two, I gradually began to be able to designate who was doing what voice. So I want to ask you, did you, although it's very anarchic, it is very British in many ways, the Goons, had you had a grounding in British comedy much prior to that, no?
I've always been a big fan of Python and Fawlty Towers and Dad's Army and even the Goodies, stuff like that, even though some of it I learned about after the Goon Show. But
I'm sorry to laugh. Yeah. I'm sorry laughing. I'm just thinking, you said even the Goodies. I hope Graham Garden and Bill Oddie aren't listening.
Well, the interesting thing is that Spike's books aren't really in print in North America. I remember I had to order them off Amazon.co.uk, mm-hmm. which I think is a shame, especially for Pacoon, which is one of the funniest books I've ever read. Probably the gold standard in written British humor for me is P.G. Woodhouse.
Oh, yeah.
Who also isn't in print here, but I just think he's incredible.
Well, he's telling me P.G. Woodhouse is out of print in North America because I'm sure that didn't he go and live in America at one point? Doesn't Jeeves and Wooster isn't Jeeves and Wooster quite popular?
The series, and I remember when I first started collecting Woodhouse books, he was in print and easy to find in the stores, But
Right.
yeah,
Okay.
apparently in the last 4 or 5 years, he's gone off the boil, and I'm not exactly sure why.
Fashions change, and people, you know, artists or authors or whatever they may be, fall in and out of fashion, don't they? Sadly.
It's like with the big controversy with him, maybe it's because I'm Canadian, but I find the whole thing a bit ridiculous because so they're changing a few words, but at least they're still in print.
Yeah, well, oh, you're talking about the lack, some of the language. When you said the controversy, I thought you meant, 'cause wasn't he was he was he had these kind of, there were rumors about him and the Nazis, or at least that he was sympathetic, perhaps, or
Well, if you read the transcripts of the broadcasts, they don't seem sympathetic at all. But he's just making Jeeves and Wooster jokes about the Germans. It's like he had no idea what was going on in the war. For me, it came more out of a place of ignorance than sympathy.
ignorance. Yeah, that's the word I was searching for before. Yeah, he was a little bit, I won't say he was simple, he was just a bit naive, a bit naive. Because of course he, who was it? Roderick Spode was his Oswald Mosley avatar. So you listened to all these Goon shows in the course of a week. So, I mean, that must have been. Did you have any time to do anything else?
Not really. Not really. I was just laying there on the beach. The second one I heard, so I heard the secret escritoire, then the Spanish suitcase, then the telephone, which
Okay.
may have my favorite scene in any Goon show. I was a bit surprised to hear you repeatedly mention Series 5 as the fan favorite series, because I much prefer Series 7 because it strikes this perfect balance between earlier goons and late goons. Some of the later stuff seems to have very little structure or order, but Series 7 is like that perfect midpoint sweet spot, at least for me.
No, well, I'm sure I've said on here. I know that a lot of fans, yeah, a lot of Goon Show fans, the traditionalists, if you like, hold up Series 5 as the strongest series, and there's a lot of great shows. But I think I've said on here, maybe I haven't, but I'm sure I've said that I think Series 7 is my favorite as well, because pretty much for the reasons that you've just given there, they've been let off the leash from Peter Eaton, but they've still got Pat Dixon, who's, you know, who's a strong producer, and they haven't yet entered the no man's land of Series 8 with all the chopping and changing of producers.
Now, here's a question about a joke I've always had. Maybe it's a Series 6 episode. I'm not quite sure what series or what episode it is, but there's this joke that's always been one of my favorite Goon Show jokes ever, but I have no idea what it's in reference to. When someone asks Eccles, "Are you the minister who built that bridge that fell to bits?" "No." "Well, it must have been somebody like you." What is that in reference to?
Spike's total disregard for politicians and his belief that all politicians are damn bloody fools, you know what I mean?
But the way the audience responds to it makes me think that something had happened around that time. Like there was an actual minister who built a bridge that fell to
I
bits,
always see what you're saying.
or
Yeah, well, what I was trying to say was that Eccles is obviously held up as an idiot, and so that was basically indicating that all politicians are idiots. But yeah, I see what you're saying in terms of, was is there some topical, is it a topical reference? Is something, did something happen? I'm not sure. I'm not even sure of which show that is, actually. So whenever we get to that, I'll hopefully by that point I will have that information and be able to share it.
So something I have to say about Spike and Larry and just his whole dynamic with Michael Benteen, because I've worked writing what are primarily my scripts with other people. I remember when I was 16, I made this comedy film with other people, you know, contributing to the script. And I can look at that film now and be like, oh, these were all my jokes. But I would never say that the other people who wrote with me didn't have anything to do with it. I've also needed kind of an interpreter for my ideas, because they can get so off the chain at times that I'll lose perspective and just move too fast. And having some person just be able to type for you is a really important component of writing. So for someone to say, oh, he was just typing, I think that that evinces a fundamental misunderstanding of the writing process. And that's at best, but I think he was just being willfully disingenuous when he said things like that.
Totally. And I think I'm sure you've read, have you read Julie Warren's book about Larry Stevens?
No, but I'm getting it. I just heard about it.
Okay.
Because it was in one of your episodes and one of the Goon Show newsletters I got a couple months ago.
Yeah, so Julie's obviously related to Larry.
Yeah.
And she wrote this wonderful biography which didn't just look at his Goon Show writing. It was his, you know, his early life, his other writing. You know, he did a lot with Tony Hancock in the early days. They were very good friends. I think he was Hancock's best man at his first wedding.
Wow.
And he also wrote The Army Game for ITV television. And he wrote a lot, and there's a lot in the Goon Show that we owe to Larry. A couple of weeks ago, we covered the episode The Treasure in the Tower. You won't have heard that yet because it's not gone out.
Oh, that's a fantastic one.
Yeah. But so we covered that episode, and it was on that episode that was that episode had the debut of the catchphrase, "It's all in the mind, you know," which was coined by Larry, or at least Larry brought that to the Goons. Because that was a phrase that when he was a commando during the war, that was a phrase that the sergeant major would often shout at the men.
That's fascinating. So it like ties back into the themes of like wartime trauma that kind of motivated the Goon Show to begin with.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Something I wanted to bring up about catchphrases.
Mm-hmm.
Spike had a lot of catchphrases that didn't seem like catchphrases, but things that he would obsessively repeat for one episode and completely drop.
Yeah.
And I know it's not just Spike, because the White Netty trade, which he had nothing to do with, uses that too. I think, like, you know, that's a horse of a different color, or on this magic lantern slide, or it says here in small print.
Yes.
That kind of thing.
What happened to the,
I'm wondering
the
if
the crispy bacon we had before the war?
What's become of that crispy bacon we had before the war, eh?
Yes, but that's more of a joke. Like, some of these repeated phrases were like half jokes that seemed to, he seemed to want to add to the texture of the script by just firing so many things at us that we didn't know what to laugh at or what was funny. I almost feel like he was intentionally doing these half jokes, and I'm not sure why.
Just to pad out the script, maybe? I don't know. Maybe that's a bit cynical to suggest that. But I guess he was a jazz man, wasn't he? And I suppose you could say it's almost it imbues within the Goon Show a certain type of rhythm. If you have these repetitive tropes, lines, quotes, catchphrases, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, because when we were first in contact many months ago, and you had a list of things that you wanted to talk about. One of the things you wrote was that you want to discuss why knees are inherently funny.
Yes.
So go on.
I have never heard of anyone having a knee fetish except for Spike Milligan. Ever. It's the most bizarre item of the body to be fixated on. And the fact that he keeps going back to it makes it funnier and funnier. He seems to have an obsession with certain things, knees and people struggling to get into doors.
Yes.
But my favorite door scene of all time, as well as my favorite Eccles and Blue Bottle scene of all time, actually in the same episode, The Dreadful Revenge of Fred Fu Manchu, which I was initially going to talk about, but given this is only my second appearance on a podcast, I didn't want it to blow up into my face.
Yeah, it could have been your last one.
Yeah, but yeah, that Minnie and Henry door bit.
Mm.
Who's that?
It's me!
Henry, there's a man called me at the door.
Me?
Me.
You'll have to prove it. You out there?
Yes?
Prove you're me.
All right, I'm Henry Crun.
Oh, that's me, Minnie, yes. Min, open the door and let him in.
But you are in, him.
Well, you'll have to let me out again.
Why?
Because I'm out there waiting to come in.
Oh, very well.
Thank you. Now then, Mr. Crumb, I want to warn you that...
Who's that out there?
It's me. Lock me out.
Nonsense. Me just came in. He's here now.
No, me. Minnie.
Good heavens, quick! That's the woman I'm here to protect. Open the door!
Very well, but I must let Minnie in first.
Oh, thank you, Henry.
Oh, that's all right, Min. Now then, dear, what were you... Who's there?
It's me!
It's probably my own personal favorite Goon Show episode.
Is it?
And it's not.
Mm.
Yeah, it's not. I have to stress, it's not because of the racism at all, but I feel like it gets closer to the heart of what you and Roger were talking about in your China Story episode, Spike said that he was trying to make fun of the cliche racism that he had been taught as a child and that had, you know, flourished during the war. Mm-hmm. He was trying to make his caricatures so extreme that we would recognize they were caricatures of caricatures.
Mm-hmm.
And the way Fu Manchu is treated in that show, while still incredibly problematic and not something I would defend exactly, seems to be his most successful employment of that concept in a way that the audience can actually understand. I mean, Spike wasn't very subtle. I wouldn't use the word subtle to describe his humor.
No.
But the interesting thing about the China Story is that little the critics thing?
Yes.
At the end of the season 5 compendium, where one of them seems to get it, seems to say, I love the Chinese noises in the China story last night, and how wonderfully un-Chinese they were.
Mm-hmm.
So if that is taken kind of as a sample of the way that the audience viewed the show at the time, then maybe Milligan was successful, but it's such a slippery slope and such a difficult concept to execute successfully that I'm not sure he ever did it. I remember seeing Spike doing blackface in one of the later Q series. Mm-hmm. I think it was like the 80s, and I couldn't believe it because North America was still racist in the 80s, but like you could never get away with a thing like that over here in the 80s.
Oh, well, look, I mean, yeah, there was plenty of comedies in the 80s that still had there was still racist language, and there was even supposedly right on comedies like The Young Ones, there was some questionable language used. And
I do love the young ones. That's a great show, but like any great show, it has massive flaws.
What's its biggest flaw, do you think?
I think just, well, that, of course, and sometimes the performance style for me is almost too aggressive, and it can sometimes take away from the brilliance of the joke writing, at least to me. But I understand that's a stupid complaint, because it's like complaining that the Goon Show is too silly.
Yeah.
it totally misses the point, but I guess it's a matter of personal preference.
Just stick with The Young Ones for a moment. Did Rick Mayall, Rick Mayall never made it in, certainly not in the United States, nor in Canada, I guess. Rick Mayall never really cut through. Why do you think that is?
Well, The Young Ones has always had a very checkered, awful DVD and VHS release history, to the point where, you know, you can only get Region 2 DVDs of it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people over here have no idea what The Young Ones is. Now, one of my favorite American sitcoms of all time, Get a Life, was described as an attempt to do an American Young Ones, to the point where there's a bit in one episode where they rip off a character's head and kick it around like a football.
Okay. Like in Bambi.
Yes, like in Bambi.
Wow, here's the label from that accursed seafood that started it all. Take that. What's this? A warning about the warning. As stated in the first warning, those who eat this rancid fish will develop amnesia. However, it will wear off all by itself. Ah, phew, well, that's a relief. What's this? P.S. But they will remember everything that happened, so don't mistreat them or make them do any goofy crap, or they may rip your head off. Hi, guys. Done dancing so soon? What are you doing something with the head there, and you're gonna do it. God, no! Ah.
I seem to remember, this might be a false memory, we're probably talking 12 years ago, probably when you first heard The Goons, I saw on YouTube or similar a really bad pilot episode for an American version of The Young Ones. And I think it had Nigel Planer in it.
Yes, I would love to track that down, because that was done, I think, by David Merkin, who show ran seasons 5 Simpsons. And 6. Of, yeah, he show ran my personal favorite seasons of The Simpsons, which is right up there with The Goon Show as one of my favorite pieces of media ever.
Mate. Which is your favorite Simpsons episode? Can you pin it down?
Burns Air, actually.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one.
Just the he card read good
bit.
Yeah,
that's great.
It just kills me.
Do you know what I love? My favorite episode, and people always say, what? That's a weird thing. It's a weird episode to have as your favorite episode. Mine will always be, and I think it might be season six. And Maggie Makes Three.
That's a fantastic episode.
And I'm not particularly a fan of Maggie, or, you know, not that I dislike Maggie, but I just love the subplot of Homer working at the bowling alley. And you might be able to help me here. You might be able to help me, because over here there's one little tiny little throwaway line in that episode which always floors me, kills me, right? And it's when Homer's being forced to leave his job. He has to quit his job because, you know, but everyone's sorry to see him go, and they give him this jacket, and they're all sort of saying bye, Homer. And then there's this little boy, like a little 1930s shoeshine boy. And Homer says, what does he say? Don't worry, Joey, we'll get to California one day. And then he goes, sure we will, Mr. Homer. Sure we will. And then he goes, and I know why that's funny, but I can't explain to people why that is funny. I just know it's parodying.
Yes.
It's parodying those sort of films, I suppose, like The Grapes of Wrath and things like
that. Yes, yes. Yeah. That's what I would say to that. Yeah, it's so weirdly specific and generic at the same time that I definitely understand why you would think that there was some cultural context behind it.
Back to the Goons. So you want to make a defense of Series 8, yeah?
Yeah, I think I like almost every single episode in Series 8. The only one I don't like is The Junk Affair, because that Blood Knock and Sea Goon phone bit goes on way too long, and there's no punchline at all. And despite the, my client has been taken ill with head, the Sea Goon Blood Knock bit totally destroys the episode for me. There's one in Series 5 that I just hate.
Okay.
And that's it. It's just because I recognize it's a good episode, and it's a funny episode, but in Forog, which weirdly enough I think was an Eric script. But when I listened to Forog, and before I knew that, I thought that it was Milligan kind of looking into the face of his depression and, you know, sense of identity loss. And it actually reminds me of that Small Dreams of a Scorpion poetry book that he had. Yeah. And it's just so depressing, particularly because I really struggle with mental health issues myself. And that's one of the reasons Milligan's one of my personal heroes, because he was insanely productive while battling, you know, similar things. I'm not going to go into detail, obviously, but yeah, that episode just puts me in a real bad psychic place.
Oh, wow.
Even though it's got great jokes in it, it's one of the most depressing things I've ever heard. I have no idea why, but that ending, you know, where Sea Goon realizes not only does Forog not exist, but he doesn't exist. And it just ends with him crying.
Yeah.
That whole ending just seems like a cry of pain.
Now, Sea Goon lad, Have you placed all the bricks in the right holes and the right squares?
Stop this nonsense. I don't know what's the matter with you all. I demand to see the authorities.
Of course you will be able to see them in a short while. They are collecting evidence at the minute.
I don't understand what this is all about.
Good morning, Dr. Moriarty.
And good morning to you, Dr. Eidelberger. And this here is little Ned Seagoon, eh?
Doctor, have they examined the forog?
They have. It's turned out to be fog.
It's not. It's not, I tell you. It's forog.
Yes. Take it easy now.
Did you find Major Bloodnock?
Yes, we have checked with the War Office records and find there is no such man of that name ever existed.
Huh? But I am lying. Go to my government-sponsored laboratory, and you'll see his name in the visitor's book.
Yes, we've checked with that address you gave us, but there is no laboratory there. It is an old bomb site.
Honestly, there is a laboratory. There must be a laboratory. As true as my name is Ned Seagoon.
Ah, that's another point. There is no such person as Ned Seagoon. Now, just put these little squares in.
Okay, I'm going to ask a few obvious questions, all right?
Okay.
Which is your favorite show?
My favorite Goon show, as I said, was The Dreadful Revenge of Fred Fu Manchu.
Yeah, of course you did. All right, ignore that question. Sorry. Okay. That is your favorite show. Well, tell you what, you can, if you like, because I'm scheduled up to the end of this year, but next year you could come and talk about that show.
Oh, that would be great. But there's, and like anyone who's listening to this podcast, you know, anyone who may have heard it from me, you know, spreading this podcast around as I will, do not listen to The Dreadful Revenge of Fred Fu Manchu as your first Goon show.
One. Two, three. Four. Five. Six. It's getting difficult here. Seven. A good job I went to college. But come up to seven.
What did you say? I can't hear what did you say.
I said, what comes up to seven?
I can't hear it.
Okay, I'll come over. Blue bottle. Ooh. What's this custard on the wall?
Don't you touch me, you rotten swine! Scrape me off and take me home.
So, what about which characters appeal to you the most, and which characters appeal to you the least in the Goons?
Well. This is gonna be a controversial opinion here. Mm-hmm. I love Eccles. Eccles is my favorite character by far. I think Eccles is my favorite character in like all of media. And don't get me wrong, there are some really, really, really funny blue bottle bits, but I feel like too many of them fall into formula and just repetition of jokes, and sometimes they slow the show down for me, even when I find Blue Bottle really funny. So Blue Bottle's my least favorite character. Now that may have something to do with the fact that my dad refuses to listen to the show with me because he finds Blue Bottle so irritating.
Right.
I feel like Series 5 Blue Bottle is the best Blue Bottle because that's when he actually sounded like a little kid. For some reason, Sellers sometimes seems to put less energy into his line readings sometimes when we get to, like, say, series 9.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
The Blue Bottle voice changes, and I just miss the series 5 Blue Bottle, you know, Kinge of the Jungle.
Yeah.
that kind of thing.
What about the music? What do you think of the music?
I love Max Gildray. I love Max Gildray.
Okay.
Okay. This is going to sound weird and incredibly nitpicky, but I have OCD.
Mm.
The way that Ray Ellington sometimes pronounces, I love, like, he'll make R sounds.
Yeah.
Like, I love you, like that,
yeah.
for example.
Yeah.
And the repeated R sounds when there should be no R sounds in the word, it just irritates me. I have no idea why, and it's definitely not a knock on him as a singer, but it's just a continued trait that I find a little irritating. Now, I love jazz. I am a huge jazz fan. Have been ever since I was a little kid, actually. But I've always preferred instrumental jazz to
vocal
jazz. Mm. So maybe that's why I prefer Gildray.
Mm-hmm.
There's just something about the improvised nature of instrumental jazz that really gets me, and I feel like you can hear more improv in Gildray than Ellington. Although Ellington does have Dickie Katz, who's a good enough pianist to swing with any of the American bands or groups. Mm. So,
sometimes some of Ray's numbers can be a bit cute, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
A bit twee, a bit dare I say it, a bit embarrassing. You know, like when he gets the band barking and stuff like that. There's an episode, which one was it? It was Treasure in the Tower again, where right at the beginning, Ray's doing some rather dubious Chinese impressions as well. Things like that.
Yeah. Well, like, here's the thing. I see comments underneath Spike's videos, and maybe this is just my modern perspective of Spike, but like, these performers didn't mind. Ray Ellington didn't say anything, you know. Harry Secombe laughed at the overweight jokes, which I must admit I laugh at too, because like I said, they're so ridiculous that it isn't like they're being aimed at one person. It's like the concept itself that's being joked with. Like, I heard they had to send up a rocket to photograph the other side of you, you know?
Well, yeah, and that continues more or less to this day. If you look at The Simpsons again, what do they say about Homer? His ass has got its own postcode or something like that.
Yeah, but recently, that there's been, you know, within the last decade, there's been a real crackdown on what is called fat shaming. Yeah. And those kind of jokes have disappeared in most modern sitcoms.
I don't watch Modern Simpsons anymore. I've kind of gave up.
Oh.
So is it worth...
I gave up.
Is it worth pursuing? No? No.
The last season was one of their best in a while. They got a new showrunner, thank God.
Hmm.
Matt Selman, who had been co-showrunning the last 3 seasons, took over a showrunning role from Al Jean, who had been sucking the life out of the series for longer than the series was ever good.
Hmm.
And it's just... they're doing more conceptual episodes. There was one where someone hacked into Fox's computer and was showing the most ridiculous Simpson plot lines that were really going to anger the fans and destroy the Simpsons. So it was just this absurdist series where, like, Martin becomes a chain-smoking adult who's disguised in a kid's body. You know, that kind of thing. So they're really experimenting more again.
Isn't the danger there of becoming too self-referential, too meta, too self-indulgent?
Well, that's something that has been baked into the show for so long that, you know, when you... I honestly think the series should have ended with Behind the Laughter.
I'm inclined to agree with you. Yeah.
Can we return to the goons for a sec? Because I had a point that I didn't clearly articulate.
Oh, go. Please do.
But when people say that, you know, Ray Ellington didn't mind, or Harry Secombe didn't mind, or just things like that, if Ray Ellington did mind, you know, what were the consequences of his career and life? How would have they turned out if he actually did speak up? So, you know, there's a general sense to a lot of these comments I read and hear about, you know, oh, this stuff never hurt anyone, or, you know, I laugh the hardest at this joke and I'm fill in ethnicity. Of course you do, but the laughter is tinged with pain, and then, you know, it perpetuates itself in future dealings with other people. It, you know, can harm self-image. It's just really, I just don't think that people understand what that kind of humor can do to a person, even if you do find it funny. The really big offender to me is all that stuff about Max Gildray's nose.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
The intros, when we come into series 9, the intros to Max become incredibly lazy. You know, you go from here comes Max Gildray to play his hot underwear to the nose. Oh, my nose. Oh, my conk is still getting the breaks over and over again in every show. Like,
yeah.
And it begins to, like, it is literal objectification. Like, there's this character in Hard Times by Charles Dickens who everybody keeps on referring to as hands, because that's the only part of his body that can work, and that's the only part of his body that matters. So he's just been boiled down to his hands. And, you know, Max with his nose. And I feel like Spike fought the Nazis. Spike, you know, Spike was one of the good guys, hopefully. And why didn't he realize, you know, what he had been fighting for and just knocked it off with the Jewish jokes? Like, I don't understand that.
Yeah, well... Because, of course, you've got the character of Lou, who crops up now.
He's hilarious. I got to say, he's hilarious. Is.
And does he get a free pass because Sellers was Jewish?
Yes, he does.
Mm.
Neddy, little Neddy. Sit down. Yeah, ever chop liver cigarette?
No, thanks. I always chop my own.
Good luck. Listen, Schlepper, listen. The lines between the Hastings and Pevensey Bay Station are under 20 feet of snow.
But something else I would like to say...
Yeah, go for it.
And I want to get this in really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that this generation is more enlightened and more in tune with the world than any other really falls apart when you think what we're doing to our planet and how future generations are going to judge us for what we're doing to the planet. So us operating on a kind of ethical superiority kind of falls apart when you think about that.
On that, you and Spike would be 100% aligned if Spike was still around today.
I'm sorry if I'm going off on a political rant here. You can edit most of this
That's
out.
That's all right. That's all right. amongst your peers, amongst your friends, your social group, have you tried to play them the Goons? Have you tried to introduce them to the show?
Well, I quote the Goons all the time in my house.
Okay.
And my friends and family are just like, well, I like them when you do them, but delivered at the pace that they're at, it's just that they can't understand it no matter how many times I play it to them, which I think is a credit to Spike, because that's something cutting edge in the 50s, incredibly cutting edge, is so ahead of its time that it continued to flummox and confuse people today who have heard like 5 or 6 episodes. That's a real testament to how ahead of its time it was.
Mm-hmm.
Something I am quite proud of, I have a couple of years ago, my whole family started calling each other Jim after sentences like so we're constantly doing the Jim Spriggs bit, and we do it so much that it's turned into muscle memory. Basically, how are you doing today, Jim? How are you doing today, Jim? So
I'd run a mile from your house if I heard every member coming out with that.
No, it's something we all love doing. I didn't push it on anyone.
People who know this podcast know that I'm a bit cool about Hancock's Half Hour. I make no bones about it, but because I listen to Hancock's Half Hour, and I love Golden and Simpson. I love Steptoe and Son. Have you?
Steptoe and Son is great.
Yeah, I love their work on that, but Hancock's Half Hour, I've always been a bit sort of about, and because it sounds like what it is, a 1950s radio comedy show, whereas the Goon Show, you listen to a great episode of the Goon Show, it doesn't sound like a 1950s radio show. It just sounds like an oral cartoon. Obviously there's references in it that will give away the time period that it was broadcast and whatnot, but in some ways, if you get the right show, the right scenes, if you catch the right bits of it, it's absolutely timeless, and it sounds fresh even now.
The TV stuff is better for me. I watch the TV stuff more than I do the radio show.
Telly Goons, or do you mean Hancock?
Yeah, Hancock.
All right. I was going to say the Telly Goons. Have you seen any Telly Goons?
Seen all the Telly Goons. God.
Right.
Horrendous.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm doing an episode on them. I'm supposed to be doing an episode on them later this year. Well, I want to, because it's the 60th anniversary in October.
Not how I want to picture them at all.
No.
That Eccles design is hideous. back to Hancock for a second.
Mm-hmm.
I think the closest thing that American comedy has to British humor and like British kitchen sink realism, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. the closest thing we've ever gotten to that on American sitcoms is The Honeymooners.
Okay, yeah.
It's just got this sense of dread, and you can just feel the poverty and the suffering that these characters go through, but it's not dwelt on. And I feel some of that same energy in Hancock.
Right.
Something else I wanted to say about radio.
Before you do, can I just ask about The Honeymooners? Because I don't think I've ever seen a whole episode all the way through.
It's fantastic.
But I'm aware it's Jackie Gleason, yeah?
Yeah.
And I'm aware of its legacy. Okay.
Yeah.
But the 1950s in America, wasn't that sort of held up as being, wasn't the projection that it was America had come out of the war triumphant, and the 1950s yeah. was a time of hope and positivity, and everyone had huge cars, and you know, everything was great, great, great. I know that wasn't the reality, but how did the Honeymooners, or the writers of the Honeymooners, or the producers, how did they kind of square that with putting out this situation comedy that was more or less saying life's crummy? How did they get away with that in that era?
Because Jackie Gleason, who was even more popular for his variety shows, the Honeymooners actually didn't really rate all that highly initially. I think it was always in the top 10, but it never reached the heights that I Love Lucy did, at least in the ratings. But I think it was that Jackie Gleason had come from a place of poverty, and he wanted to create a character who would fight his way through poverty just like his parents had, and just put some of that pain of the poverty of his early life into his comedy. So he wanted to give back in a way.
Okay.
But one thing I want to say about radio.
Yeah.
And also the way my generation and those younger than me consume media. I, like, from the ages of, I would say 11 to 16, I was very much into old time radio. You know, Fibber McGee and Molly, Jack Benny, Fred Allen. Those kind of things. So when I first heard the Goon Show, it was just like Eric Sykes said, the roof came off and it was all sunshine. It just, so I don't have the problems of anything being a 1950s radio sitcom, because I love 1950s radio sitcoms.
Yeah.
The Goon Show, I barely even consider a sitcom.
No. Well, it's a variety show, technically, I suppose, because it's got music in it. But and sometimes you could almost say it was a sketch show, particularly in the early days. Here's an interesting question for you, actually.
Yeah.
Because I've been editing something else recently, and I won't go into it. But the person, it was a recording I've done previously that I'm sort of putting together, and one of the comments that the gentleman in question made was that he said, he kind of basically said, be careful what you wish for. And what he meant was, what, you know, let's consider that somehow one day somebody's grandfather passes away and they're clearing out his loft, his attic, and they come across a box full, a crate full, a tea chest full of recordings of, I don't know, series 2, series 3 Goon shows that you know, he had recorded onto disc, or, you know, old sort of reel to reel cassettes. Even let's assume that they hadn't deteriorated, that they were still playable and they were good quality, okay? And the sky would be dark with hats. It would be considered you know, one of the greatest comedy finds of the decade. Yeah?
Yeah.
But this guy I was talking to, he said, look, you know, he kind of basically said, be careful what you wish for, because they're probably not very good, those shows, because they were still finding their feet. And he's a huge advocate, huge fan of the Goons. You know, he wasn't saying, he was saying, you know, they probably wouldn't be that funny.
The Encyclopedia Goonicus has all the scripts, doesn't it?
It does. It does. But
have you gone through any of the early scripts?
Not to a great extent, but I'm a script is one thing, because I think 50% of it is the script, 50% of it is the performance.
Yeah.
And I from the handful of very old Goon shows, I say very old, you know, there's a couple from series 2, there's a couple from around that period, they didn't seem as loose, as confident, as assured of themselves. The performance, you know, Milligan, Seacombe, Sellers, even Benting.
I remember you did an episode on the case of the Vanishing Room.
Yes.
Comparing it to its series 4 version, and the more, because I just got the Goon Show compendiums on audiobook.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, for any Canadian fans who may be listening, the Goon Show audiobooks are available at the Apple Bookstore for like $16 a piece. So,
wow.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know the exchange rate, how much that is in British pounds, but that doesn't sound like very much at all.
It's not.
Well, that's a perfect example, because we covered the Vanishing Room with Mike Haskins. And I mean, I'm not a big fan particularly of the Vintage Goon series either. There's a few good ones in that, but you know, they were made under rather strained circumstances. But the Vintage Goons version of essentially the same script, more or less, is far superior to the Series 4 version.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the point I was making, you know, a century ago, was that if a stack of old Goon shows was discovered, you kind of worry that, you know, they might not be that good. We've been spoilt by having the main extant Goon shows have been from Series 5 onwards, which is when the show really got into its stride. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay, here's a question I have. Do you know if The Curse of Frankenstein was always the title of the script? Because it's always seemed to me like a very bad joke followed by the actual episode title, which is "My heart's in the Highlands and my feet are in Bombay," or "I was the victim of a terrible explosion." Like, why is that not the episode title? And everything I can find on it lists it as "The Curse of Frankenstein."
Because "The Curse of Frankenstein" is a pithier, quicker title than "My heart is in..." What was it again? I've forgotten already.
My heart's in the Highlands, but my feet are Bombay. In Bombay.
Yes, yes.
But that's a much funnier title.
True. Again, it's just Spike playing with the form.
Mainly. Yeah.
Spike just messing with the audience. You know. because you look at, I don't know, World War One, the episode World War One from Series 8. What's that? What's the title of that when it's written down?
Part one.
Yeah.
Now that's a really good episode.
That is.
I love the ending. The ending is just perfection in that episode.
Here is a special news bulletin. British troops will come home from France at once.
Hooray, folks! They think it's 1904. The plan worked. My German army shares will be worth a fortune.
Wrong. What? The British dropped 1918 calendars on Berlin, and the Germans surrender.
Oh, dear.
Sounds like the end, doesn't it, Wall?
Perfectly correct, Mr. Seagun. Good night.
Good night, Wall.
I can hear your socks, Moriarty. I know you're there.
Yeah, that's a talking point. The Goon Show endings tend to be, certainly as the show went on, they tended to be kind of throwaway endings, didn't they? Generally, with a few good ones like that one.
The other example I can think of that ends really well is the Battle of Spy and Cop. That's just changing history. So Napoleon won Waterloo. Okay, folks, get your new history books.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I really like that ending. It feels like it was more planned than other endings. A lot of shows just seem to stop with no end punchline.
They do.
And there's a bunch of shows where they lampshade the point that they don't have any punchline and say, you know, okay, well, give us a 5-mile start. Don't let the audience know that was the ending.
Yeah.
Oh, one thing I wanted to talk about.
Mm.
Now, apart from comedy, my main obsession is literature, and Kafka is my absolute favorite author. And the Goons were compared to Kafka in the 50s.
Yes.
And I just, you know, as someone who's read Kafka repeatedly, I kind of want to talk about the where I think it's similar and where I think it differs. Because I think a lot of those comparisons were incredibly off base.
Well, I've read the Trial, of course. I've read The Castle.
Yeah.
Which was I must admit, I found The Castle was a real slog. I don't know. You probably love The Castle, do you?
I love The Castle. I like it more than The Trial.
Oh, okay. And I've read Metamorphosis, of course. But yeah, they were compared to Kafka, but I mean, Kafka's just like existential nightmare bureaucracy, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Actually, the Borog is the most Kafka-esque episode of the Goon Show because it's the only one that has that existential, you know, bone-deep dread that Kafka is all about. There's one story of his called The Hunger Artist that functions as this very, very dark joke. Probably the most overt use of humor in his his books.
Yeah.
It's a story about a man who has been starving for months and months and refuses to eat and you know, gets very emaciated and thin and almost dies. And at the moment they you know, say, you know, we're going to have someone else in this cage because you're awful to look at and you're
right.
You're driving the customers away and everything. And as he's dying, someone asks him, why did you starve yourself for all this time? And he says, well, because I couldn't find anything I wanted to eat.
Right. That does sound like something kind of Milligan. Have you ever read Hunger by, is it Knut Hamsun, the Norwegian writer?
I have not heard of him, but if he's anything at all like Kafka,
Okay, if you like Kafka, you probably like that. Maybe not, but...
Okay, fantastic.
Give it a go.
I'll give it a go. One more thing, sure. I would like to say.
Yeah.
I think there's a fundamental difference in the way that your generation consume media and the way mine does and people who are younger than me, because we can basically, with all these old radio shows and all these movies are available, we basically have the entire history of entertainment at our fingertips.
Yeah.
So it's like you find someone who was influenced by someone else, then you go and hear that thing, and then everything's kind of connected because there's comedians influence, then more comedians, then more influenced, then who they influenced, and people who were influenced by them, and it's just a long, long chain. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Can you point to echoes of the Goon Show in modern comedy, even today? You know, can
Tim and Eric?
Okay.
Tim and Eric.
Yeah, I've seen a bit of Tim and Eric. Okay. Yeah.
Just in the pace.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have a lot of times they'll have these sketches that are like maybe 50 seconds long or 30 seconds long. No sketch usually breaks 2 minutes, and they're 11-minute shows. So sometimes you'll get maybe 10 sketches a show or something insane. So it just, like the Goon Show, it just bombards your brain. So yeah, when I watch Tim and Eric, I sometimes think of the Goon Show. And actually, I've been trying to combine the Kafka side of my influence with the Milligan side. And I actually think that there's a show that already did that, which I've recently discovered, called Jam.
Oh, Chris Morris.
Yes.
Yes.
I love it, but again, people do not watch that show.
No.
Or you'll think I'm a terrible person for loving it. You know, it's just one of those things.
Chris Morris's most mainstream work, I think, is probably The Day to Day. Remains The Day to Day.
I love Brass Eye too.
Well, yeah, but Brass Eye is great, but there's certain editions of Brass Eye that would raise some eyebrows today, for sure.
Oh, totally. Like, oh. Actually, just one more point I wanted to make. There is a scene in Brass Eye that I think attempts the same thing that Milligan did, or Milligan was trying to do. I think it's in the crime episode where a character gets in, like a white character gets into blackface.
Now chafing the transmission heads, what is the relationship between crime and race? Using makeup sticks, we transformed our white reporter, Tras Dupre, into a black man to see if the law would treat him any differently. Within 5 minutes, he'd committed a pocket theft, and by mid-afternoon, he was attacking passers-by with violent muggings and fleecing them viciously on the cobbles.
Like, I can understand where that joke was coming from and what it was trying to do, but it's just distasteful, even though conceptually it's funny.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He was trying to do a similar thing to what Spike was trying to do in Dreadful Revenge of Fred Fu Manchu, the disappointed Oriental saxophonist. And in either case, Chris Morris or Spike, I don't think any of those work. But, you know, at least they're conceptually daring. At least they're trying different things. Like, the thing with Spike, I think he was the first comedian. I just get this feeling from him, who thought of his work as like being avant-garde, just trying to play with structure, the way you tell jokes, just pieces of things like I was talking about that sound like jokes, but aren't jokes.
And I
feel like he was thinking of his stuff as not only comedy, but like art. Not higher art, of course, but, you know, it's...
Yeah.
Spike was the first avant-garde comedian.
He didn't...
I would say.
He didn't see it as disposable throwaway comedy, necessarily.
No, he didn't.
He sweated to produce these shows, to get these shows out. And he would... The last thing he would want to think of them as being disposable. Yeah. Not, as you say, art or high art, but... in their own way, an art form.
Yeah.
Mm. And on that note, I think what better place to end our conversation, Zach?
Awesome. I'd
definitely like you to come back and talk about... Well, maybe, I was thinking, I don't know, maybe there's another Goon Show you'd come back and talk about rather than...
Okay. Okay. The Telephone.
Great. I love The Telephone. No one talks about The Telephone. I love that. I think it's a great episode.
The Telephone... Did anyone do Shifting Sands yet?
No.
Okay. Okay, Shifting Sands.
All right, then. We'll do Shifting Sands with one of the best Blood Knock scenes, the scene with him and chin strap.
Oh, my God.
I have certainly used that line or a variation of that line in real life on a number of occasions. I suppose you're wondering why you sent for me. okay, so we will meet again. It'll probably be next year, Zach. I'm scheduled right up the wazoo for the rest of the year. But maybe next year you could come back and talk about Shifting Sands. So I'll put you down on the list for that. And it's been a real pleasure speaking with you. It's been great having such a different perspective from someone, you know. I have had someone who's younger than you as a guest.
Yeah.
Only marginally.
Yeah, the Spring Robberies episode.
The Spring Robberies with Molly. You know, she came from that, you know, let's face it, you know, she grew up in Britain. It was more, you know, she had a parent who introduced her. So, you certainly stand out in terms of how you came to the Goons, your cultural upbringing being so different, not that different, but, you know, different.
Yeah.
So it's been a real eye-opener, and you've raised so many interesting points and made so many interesting points. So
I would love to be back as soon as possible. I know you got shows booked up until the end of the year, but I loved being on this show. I've been excited about it for months, honestly.
Oh, well, bless you. Oh, well, listen, thanks again, mate, and we will talk again soon.
Okay.